you know, in the bush area, because it costs so much to, you know, to fly around. It'd be better to have a licensed personnel out there.
Representative Larson.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess my questions or concerns is in relation to the audit that was done by Legislative Budget and Audit. Have you had an opportunity to read the audit?
Yes.
As I read the audit, it seemed to me that the criticism was more in relation to the action of the board, and as a result of the previous action that the board had taken in numerous instances, that the recommendation was that if they were going to continue that way, they should just be done away with. Did you have any response then in relation to the audit?
The old boards, now you got to realize that this has been back 20 years ago. You know, it was really tough. And the board did a lot of things that they ought not have done. You know, like when there was, when I was on the board there, once in a while, we'd have a person who would have 1 point. You know, we'd miss the test by one. Do you deny this guy a livelihood, or do you go back and rebuild and say, well, it was a minor? And when we were there, we took into consideration, you know, what the question was they missed, you know, and whether this is right to deny a guy a livelihood for 1 point. And this is the thing that the audit got on us for, because we're too much of a human interest. Because we believed in, you know, these people making a livelihood. And as long as they did the practical work beautifully, and they missed a little bit on the written, that's some of the problems we had.
Would you have any comments in relation to whether the board should be extended for another period of time to, I think it's 4 years, or should it be 1 year or 2 years? Or
I like to see it alternate, you know, have 4 years, but new members put on. We need to get, how am I going to word this so I get myself in trouble? We need to get rid of some of the older people, get the newer people on there that are upgrading our profession. Now, like I've been working on this with Sun here for I don't know how many years to get this new bill. We need it desperately. And right now, some of the older members, it's just like any kind of things, when you have changes, you have problems. And right now, we combined the two boards together, you know, the hairdressers and the barber boards together. And they had a little friction, which you can understand that. Now that it's gone, I think that this will be eliminated. You know, as we look and see who we put on, there's lots of times our people will put somebody on just because they're a friend. They don't look and see what their qualifications are. And I think this is your job and our job to make sure that these people are qualified. And that's what's happened in the past. You know, if we just don't put the right people on the right qualifications.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Szymanski.
Thank you. Are you a barber or a hairdresser or whatever?
I'm a hairstylist. I've gone to both.
So you're licensed?
As a barber.
As a barber. So you're not licensed to deal with the chemicals or anything else?
Right. But I have gone to school down below and took a training on chemicals.
But you don't use chemicals now then?
No. But with my shop, I wanted to know what was going on in case there was a problem. So I have taken training. I have probably got more hours than most of my people in the shop have.
Let me ask the one I'm dying to ask. What is this other critter that we call an estetician or whatever the heck it is?
I'll have Sun answer that one.
I figured out barbers, I got cosmetologists, but I'm not quite sure what these other ones are.
This one we put in for as a hairdresser's. They wanted it, they got it.
Anybody know what it is?
Yes, go ahead.
An esthetician is another word for facialist. All they do is work on facials. They work on the face, the neck, the head, as far as the skin, or manipulation to the massaging the scalp, the tops of the shoulders, and the arms.
Thank you.
The word esthetician comes from France. It's just another fancy word for facial.
Right, Representative Szymanski.
Do they deal with chemicals in any way?
No, not really. All they have are just the chemical makeup of creams, but not chemicals as from waving or coloring. Not the harsh chemicals. No, they don't.
So if you went into a lady's powder room and you found all the stuff that looks like a chemistry set that's stacked up all over the walls, I mean, I call it powder room. I mean, my wife's room looks, it's got more chemicals than I think most chemical places would have. It looks like you paint on. So none of that's chemical. Well, why is it in the bill?
Is there any questions? Thank you very much, sir. The next one I'll call up is Nancy Dunn.
Can I add something?
Yes, you get 2 minutes to add it, and then you'll listen to the testimony from here on. Okay, thank you very much, Lonnie. We appreciate it. At this time, the chair will call up Nancy Dunn.
I had a question for the last speaker. I was wondering if you had any suggestions on what might help me.
Upjohn is developing something.
Save that for Representative Sonny. You'll make the last presentation. Okay. Would you state your name for the record, please?
Yes. I'm Nancy Dunn, Director of the Division of Occupational Licensing. I'd like to respond primarily to the audit recommendation that the board be sunsetted. We support this for two reasons. The first is that of the 2,600 licensees that we have attached to the board, about 70% of those have their licenses issued directly from the desk of the licensing examiner. This is in part due to a delegation letter that the board chairman sent to the division in November of 85, saying there are only a few categories that the board wishes to review, shop owners and foreign trained practitioners. And for the most part, all of the licenses that are issued completely within our office. I feel that if the board is sunsetted, we could work over the next year with them to write regulations about foreign trained applicants and to tighten up regulations if necessary on the licensing of facilities so that we could handle that additional 30% of the workload. There is one other reason. The majority of the activity of the board that I can see has to do with proctoring or being present for practical exams. Now the board, and I think this has been excellent on their part, has trained 30 proctors over the past few years, and these proctors act in the same capacity when a practical exam is given. A proctor, a board member, and another proctor work together as a team. I think that, again, with another year to work with the board, we could ensure that the existing proctors, many of whom, about half of whom, have gone through several exams, could function as head proctors. It would be people that could either be retrained or could be okayed by the board as it exists for another year is people who are professionals who are capable of determining that the outcome of a practical exam is as it should be. So those are two very basic reasons. I really feel that the division can handle all of the functions of the board as long as we have this wind down year to work out any regulation issues that might come up.
Yes. Representative Ringstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just as a basic philosophical question, why, and maybe a part of this assumption is wrong, but why should we have a group of state employees that probably, well, maybe I'm wrong on this, but probably aren't expertise in this field, and they're obviously none of us are, but why should we have them regulating this field and this whole industry rather than having the industry regulate itself? To me, it makes sense. These people know the business. They know what they're talking about. They know the rules. They know the chemicals. Why don't we let them regulate themselves instead of a bunch of bureaucrats sitting in office?
I think, there are a number of issues. One is just the economics of the situation. In my position, I would like to see resources go towards funding a board that has complex regulatory issues to address, or a large caseload of complaints. Those are two important things, the public protection aspect of it or the regulatory aspect of it. And I just don't see that with this board. We have currently two complaints pending against practitioners. That's a minute number compared to the 2,600 licensees that we have. So that's one criterion on which I'm basing my recommendation. And the other one is the complexity of the regulations. I think that in fields that are fast-growing or are complex, for example, the practice of medicine, I would no more recommend that the division take responsibility for issuing licenses than I would, for nursing. Any profession that has the potential for serious harm to the public. But in this case, we don't have a caseload that I think justifies a board getting together to discuss a complex caseload. It doesn't exist. And I also think that it's a fairly straightforward situation as long as the statutes are clearly written. One thing I would like to say about the bill as proposed is that it includes new functions which are addressed only insofar as they suggest that the board adopt regulations to lay out the details of these new professions, manicurists, pedicurists. And I would have a problem with the licensing division doing that. I certainly can't make up regulations for those fields. But the way I would propose to do it would be to hire expert witnesses, to go to the association, to go to people who do know for their assistance. But that's basically, in a nutshell, the reason. The economics and the caseload make it, I think, appropriate to go along with the audit recommendation.
Any further questions?
Mr. Chairman, just as a follow-up at, and understanding that you're kind of the new kid on the block there, some of the comments that I've heard are that it's not such that the board is not doing that much as that the agency will not allow the board to do anything, which the bureaucracy controls the money, the bureaucracy controls the rules and regulations, etc. They do not allow the board to do anything. Pretty soon you get an ineffective board. To me, the total control, from what my understanding, comes from the agency, which is just strangle the board.
Well, two things. One, the delegation order that the board chair issued to the division was with, it was at the board's instigation, and it was with the full board concurrence, and it basically shifted what's usually a board function back to the division. That, you know, I think speaks for itself. And in terms of other regulations, I think what I'm gathering is there's some dissatisfaction with the opinions issued by the Attorney General's office, which limit the board's ability to do things such as license or examine instructors in a way different from practitioners. I'm not sure, and you're right, I'm the new kid on the block, I'm not sure to what extent this division has in any way tried to constrain the board's activities.
I guess maybe the question then comes, which is the cart and which is the horse? My understanding is the agency's been doing this for a number of years, and the board's just about ready to throw up their hands unless somebody can thump the agency and tell them to get out of the way and let the board work.
I guess what I would need is more background to even be able to respond to that. And I'm not really in a position to do that after 3 weeks on the job. But I am certainly open to comments from the board members themselves about that.
Any further questions? Representative Szymanski.
Thank you. I just noticed, too, I guess Labor and Commerce added in manicure and pedicure. Must be a good thing going. I mean, all of a sudden we're going to terminate this board, and now all of a sudden we started adding in more industry to it. Has there been a new rash of movement in the manicure and pedicure business that people are losing fingers and toenails or something? I don't know. I mean, I haven't heard a constituent complain yet.
Well, you've raised an issue that I was going to raise myself in addressing the bill directly. The legislative audit report basically says sunset the board and redefine the reduce responsibilities. This bill says continue the board and increase responsibilities. The division's perspective on this is that we think we can sunset the board and take over responsibilities, especially if it's the status quo. Now, with respect to manicure and pedicure, I simply don't have the background information to say whether it seems justified or not, how many people would be licensed, whether there's public outcry for it, whether there's public protection needed in this area, and I was hoping that we would be informed by that, by some of the testimony today.
I'm looking forward to Representative Sun.
Thank you very much. Did you want to add something, Elmo?
On the back question there, when I was on the board a few years back, we won't mention how many years, but our powers were definitely taken away from us. You know, we couldn't do hardly anything without going to the Commerce, without, you know, doing these things. And we've been begging and screaming and hollering to get more powers in. And I think that this is what the whole problem is, that they've taken this away. And talking about fingers, we have these artificial nails out now, as our industry is growing. And if you do not know how to do these things, they are really dangerous, as I find it out in our shop. You've seen these claws that these women wear.
They're expensive, too, let me tell you.
I bet you. But if you don't know how to do this, you're in bad trouble, as we've went through a couple of these manicures. So, you know, time has changed. We're not back in the old Stone Age now. We're advancing, and more chemicals coming out, and we got to keep up with these things.
So thank you so much. At this time, the chair calls up Julie Ward. Would you state your name and who you represent, please?
My name is Julie Ward, and I am a local hairdresser. I'm in favor of House Bill 305. I think I've been a hairdresser in Juneau for 6 years, and I apprenticed locally. And during the time of my apprenticeship, the boards were both sunset and combined as barbers and hairdressers. There has not been an acceptable bill to this point to successfully combine the boards. And House Bill 305 does combine the licensing of both barbers and hairdressers to make it more realistic for barbers, especially that are trained down south in chemical work. And they come to Alaska and they can't do their chemical work because Alaska doesn't recognize barbers doing chemical work. This bill is set up so those people are not going to be deprived of their livelihood. And putting manicures and pedicures, those used to be licensed a couple years ago, and they somehow were removed from the bill. And they were put back in because, as Mr. Keenbaum noted, there are new nail extensions, they call them fancy nail extensions, where they use polymer resins, and you need to have certain ventilation on your equipment so your customer doesn't get gassed, however you want to say it. And also, if they're not done properly and proper training in how to do these nail extensions, you can get fungus under your nail and you can lose nails. And so that's why the manicures and pedicures are being put back into the existing bill. But I do speak highly in favor of the bill. I'd like to see keeping a board for another couple years and letting them act on this bill with the board successfully combined, and if they can't work it out better within a couple years, then perhaps maybe we should consider letting the department handle the licensing. But I would like to see the board given another couple years to get it together combined. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there any questions? Thank you, Ms. Ward. At this time, the chair calls up Victoria Pedro. Would you state your name for the record and
yes.
Who you represent, please?
I'm Victoria Pedron, and I'm one of the strange critters called an esthetician, although I am licensed as a cosmetologist. I'm speaking in support of the House Bill 305. It's my sincerest wish to see the board continued in the effect. In the hopes that professional standards will be maintained and that the professionals acting in our field will have recourse. I believe that with just the department licensing professionals, if there are mistakes or errors in the field, we're not going to be able to retrain or kind of rehabilitate the practitioner that's made an error. One of the reasons for the licensing of a manicurist and pedicurist is, as Mrs. Ward stated, to protect the public and to provide licensing for a new field coming up where a lot of artificial nail extensions are used. Also, an esthetician is someone who works primarily on the skin, and whereas we don't use noxious chemicals, we do work with electricity, and that training is needed, regulation is needed for that use. It's also an alternative it's providing a separation between people who are going to take the entire training for hair and for people who want to spend lesser amounts of hours to work only on the skin.
Is there any questions? Thank you, ma'am. Is there anybody else that would like to testify on this before I call Representative Sun back up? Representative Sun?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate the time you've offered us on this bill. I would like to propose a couple of amendments that may ease the fiscal cost on this. If people refer to page 2, line 21. That if we could move to take the examinations have been set down to be at least once each calendar quarter and delete that language and reinsert that twice in every year, we could probably cut down the fiscal cost of that. And I've also prepared another amendment, Mr. Chairman, that would help if we did that amendment there. The point being that if you the amendment being passed out would go into line, page 8, line 9, but it deals with temporary permits, and I think if we move the licensing function off to twice a year, if we took care of people who came into the state who already had licenses, that they could get a temporary permit to work until such time as the license came up every 2 years, this would give the power to issue a temporary permit to somebody who already had a license from another state. These kind of go in conjunction that way. I think it would work. The reason for having the test every calendar quarter was so that people who came in could take the exam and wouldn't be out of work. So I propose those two amendments, and if people would just hang on to those and also go to page 9, I have a third amendment here. This is a technical amendment. We missed a reference on line 1, page 9. The reference to AS 08.01.080 is incorrect, and that should be 0.065, 08.01.065, and that was a change that I think, Mr. Chairman, in your bill you made last year, we weren't quite quick enough to get it.
Does any members have any questions
to Mr. Sun regarding his three amendments he is proposing to the board, one starting with page number two regarding putting in twice a year, which would then we would be able to pass a zero fiscal note. The amendment that he has just presently passed out on page eight, starting with lines nine, and the technical amendment that he has stated. Representative Porcio.
Mr. Chairman, was there a fourth amendment that you started out saying? What was the reference on that?
The fourth amendment would be on page 7, line 20 and 21, and that was to reinsert that language, and who uses only chemicals available to the general public. And this is the small village exemption to allow that people could cut hair and take care of people in small villages or small areas without being licensed, but only that they could only use chemicals that were available across the shelf. And I would, Labor and Commerce put the deletion in there, and I would recommend the committee change that language back.
Any further questions? Representative Duncan?
Chairman, I'm not quite sure. One by one. Okay. Mr. Chairman, just to get things rolling then, I will move that we adopt amendment one proposed by Representative Sun, which is on page 2, line 20. You can delete once each calendar year and reinsert twice every year.
Is there any objections?
We're just for point of clarification.
Representative Samansky.
The specific request to make the exemption, where'd that come from? I mean, who wants the exemption? Does Bush or the rural?
We're
not talking
amendment,
about that
amendment.
We're going to talk about it. Go ahead, Ron.
Okay.
We'll get to that one in a minute.
Okay. Objection removed. Thank you. Amendment number one is adopted.
Chairman, on page 9, line 1. I would move that we change the reference to 0.08, 0.01, 0.065.
Is there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered.
Chairman, page 8, line 9, the amendment has been passed out by Representative Sun, section 16, to read. I would move that amendment.
Is there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. Amendment number 4 is on page number 7. Would you restate that again, Representative Sun?
Yeah, Mr. Representative Samansky, this deals with the exemption Bush. It's page 7, line 20. And this would be allow an exemption for hairdressers, barbers in the bush areas or communities of less than 1,000 people. But the amendment is to reinsert the language that says on line 20, and who uses only chemicals available to the general public. That, as it is now, that language is being deleted. I would recommend we reinsert it in that... would allow unlicensed people to cut hair, but not to use unlicensed chemicals.
Representative Duncan.
I would move that amendment, reinsert the language that's been deleted there.
I'd object.
There's objection?
Yeah, I think that this places a hardship on rural communities or those those communities that maybe don't have ready access to come in and get licensed. And I don't see any reason that those people out there should not have access to the same techniques in hairdressing as people in larger communities.
Representative Sun?
Yeah, my only concern there is that some of the chemicals, and one of the basic reasons for licensing is to protect the public from some of these chemicals being used by untrained people, and understanding that, you know, you can't just tell a village out in the area you can't have anybody cut hair because nobody in the village is licensed. So the compromise here was say, well, you can have someone cut hair and do this work, but not to let them use the dangerous chemicals until they got a license. And that's kind of the compromise that's worked out. It's my recommendation that we go that way. I'm not sure I want somebody unlicensed, no matter where they are, to use the heavy chemicals.
Continue.
I think Representative Porcio.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think this kind of cuts at the heart of this whole bill, really. If the testimony we've heard today, the reason or one of the primary reasons that I heard that we were licensing people at all was because of the potential to do harm or damage to the public. And if on one hand we're saying it's okay to run the risk of doing damage or harm to some of the people of this state, but not others, my reaction is, if that's a risk we're willing to take, why license people in Anchorage?
Well, I guess, Representative Porcher, your assumption would be that I support this piece of legislation, which I don't.
We have a motion before us on amendment number 4. Is the objection still maintained?
I'll remove my objection.
There you go. Amendment number 4 is adopted. Is there any questions to Representative Sun? Representative Zemanski?
I'm going to go back to the essence of that whole routine here. Who wants the exemption for rural areas? Who's asked you for it?
Well, it's always been there in the law. It's not a new exemption. That exemption is an existing statute, and I understand that I've been out in the areas, and it's just hard sometimes to get somebody's license to cut hair, and this allows those people to participate in the business and get someone in the area that can sit down and cut people's hair without violating the law. So it's been
everybody
an ongoing...
Everybody does that. I mean...
It's an exemption that is in the existing statutes.
That's only if you want to be a licensed haircutter. I mean, if you want to be an unlicensed haircutter, you can go ahead and cut hair all day long. I mean, anybody does it out here anyway, right?
This exemption would put them in the purview or make them legal.
But I'm even saying this whole hokey thing about having licenses to regulate rural barbers and beauticians and so forth, I mean, it doesn't really... Nobody in reality is going to use them. I mean, you haven't had a constituency group or anybody come to you and say, hey, we definitely want it in there.
I have had, yeah, because I have areas outside of my community that in the Craig Klovac and Heidelberg area and some of the logging camps that have requested this.
Well, then, explain a couple other little things, if you could, to me. On page 10, line 20 through 22, roughly, there's a change that talks about new scalp, face, neck, including skin care, makeup, temporary removal of superficial hair, so forth. And they're deleting the human body for the purpose, cosmetic purpose for a fee or something like that. Let me talk to me about that for a second and tell me, does this mean that the human body, we're now going to get into being able to clip non-human?
Representative Zemanski, I obviously have had not seen one of these people about my facial hair lately. But I think we had an esthetician here explain what all that was about. I think you may have stepped out of the room during that time, and she could probably explain it much better than I can.
Representative Duncan?
Chairman, as I read that, it just makes it more restrictive. Human body could be from your toes to your head, right?
Right.
And this says that if it's not your neck, scalp, face, etc.
I see what it's saying. I'm not too sure whether or not you do, but that's all right. Let me go back and ask the basic question. Why did you add manicure and pedicure in here?
For the reasons that were given in the testimony.
But I mean, what's just
the concern about the use of the chemicals and the liability and public concerns.
Do you know of any example?
I can give you.
As I've asked the previous
Representative Zemanski, yeah, you didn't ask me. I will give you Locke, Book, and Sinker. The law school tort books are replete with lawsuits dealing with fingernails disappearing, hair disappearing, eyes being burned, usually in states that are unregulated and do not have boards or regulations, but I will do my research this evening and get you all the examples you want of those cases.
Hopefully before you bring it to the floor.
Well, I'll do that as soon as possible. I have...
Any further questions? Yes, Representative Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just in relation to the board and regulations or non-regulations, what would be the implication of, say, liability insurance?
I think Representative Larson, it would be my opinion that the only question here is who's going to license and regulate, whether it's the board or Division of Occupational Licensing. The issue of not allowing, having licensing and totally deregulating this, I think, is not thinkable. I think if we did that, insurance for example, would be unobtainable in this industry. And if it would be for an outrageous price.
Thank you.
Further questions? Representative Ringstead?
I would move and ask unanimous consent that we pass out Finance CS for HB 305 with the zero fiscal note with individual recommendation.
Just a minute. Is there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. Thank you, Representative, for your time this afternoon. We enjoyed it.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. I appreciate the opportunity to entertain the committee.
I'm not sure Representative Samaski is
I did. I thought it was
great. The next bill we'll take up is committee substitute for House Bill number 113, Finance. We had this the other day. You have before you a proposed finance CS for this particular bill. We have had reviewed by the legal services and identical to what was presented by the department. We have Ken here from the administration that would. We have some questions regarding this. Would you state your name for the record, please?
Certainly. Yes, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Ken Bischoff. I'm Director of the Division of Finance, Department of Administration. I presented the bill last week. I believe it was pretty well covered there, so I'm here to answer any questions that may have remained in the committee.
Thank you, Ken. Representative Cotton.
Just let me get reorganized here. Just one technical question first, and I had another one that was on page 1926 of the CES there. That I just didn't understand how this sentence worked here. The department shall charge the reserve account with all payments for the benefits. I'm not sure exactly what you're saying there.
Mr. Chairman, perhaps it may be easier. I believe I've got a handout here, a one-page handout that explains the mechanics.
Can you answer that question for me?
Certainly. When the legislature passes agency appropriations, a portion of those are personal services budgeted funds. In the budget instructions, up front, we each year put a percentage for each of these items.
Let me just ask it for you this way. When you say the word charge, does that mean like insert, or does that mean?
We will credit the reserve account with the funds we charge the agencies. Okay, then we will charge that account when we disperse the payment centrally.
What happens is you have a reserve account that money flows into.
Correct.
For a certain purpose, and you've defined that purpose. So when that money goes into the reserve account, is that what you're saying? You're charging the reserve account when it goes in?
No, we are crediting that account. The word charge here is when we make payment for the obligation as it arises.
So you say the department shall charge the reserve account with all payments. I'm sure it's real obvious to everybody else and not me. I just missed the way it was worded there, I guess.
Not to me either.
But to assure Representative Cotton, you're not charging a percentage off of from each of one of the 18 agencies in this reserve account, are you?
Mr. Chairman, let's see if I can make this as simple and as straightforward as I can. The way the process works is each time we write a payroll warrant, that is charged against an agency appropriation. As part of the employer charges related to that payroll warrant, these items are included as part of the cost of having an employee on board. If a payroll warrant is written for $100 and 1% is for workman's compensation, then $1 will be credited to this reserve account. Then when the actual liability comes due, we will charge that reserve account to pay the claim. Sense.
Should the word on line 26 end before instead of with?
Line 24. You're reading the benefits set out in A of this section after the appropriation?
Page 1, line 25 and 26.
Line of reserve account with all payments for 401. I guess it doesn't
I just, it just confused me as to what, which way they were going with it by the language there, so.
When we charge the account, we're taking money out and paying claims. When we credit the account, we're putting money into the account for payment of future claims.
So the other question I had was on what happens when you have a shortfall. So if you run out of money, you make it pretty clear that you can take the money from what might lapse and make those payments directly, rather than you wouldn't put then take that excess amount, put it into the fund, and then pay it. Would a mechanically
we would use the same mechanics. One of those items is accepted. I believe right. The legislature reserved the right to think that the risk management portion is a big enough item or volatile enough item that it shouldn't be treated in this manner. But for the other three items, at the end of the year when we close the books, if the amounts for those other three items were over expended and we needed additional funds to bring that account balance to zero, we would look at appropriations that would otherwise lapse and charge those appropriations before we lapse them with enough monies to bring that account balance to zero.
Oh, so they would go back into the account then?
Yes.
Okay. What happens if there's an excess in the account?
Would that money then remain lapse? There, and we would reduce the subsequent year's estimation for the percentage required. Rather than lapse, the way things are.
Right now, if there's any excess money, it would lapse. Under this, it would not lapse.
I don't think it's addressed currently.
I think it is.
I think it is.
I mean, I think the way you've got this bill written, right now, what would happen is would be that there would be this.
I've got a handout.
There would be money that would be determined to be available for lapse at the end of the fiscal year, and then the money would lapse. And if it went into this fund, it would stay there, and it wouldn't lapse. That was a question I had, Mr. Chairman. It seemed like maybe in the legislature's interest to at least allow that any excess in that fund to last, although it may not be enough money to worry about. I don't know what kind of cash might be left there.
Mr. Chairman, it's basically a housekeeping function, and it would be the legislature's pleasure how they would like to view this. If you put in a provision that would require us to lapse that, it wouldn't produce a hardship because you're still allowing us to go in and assess the appropriations after the fact to get the funds we need anyway. So it really wouldn't make any difference to us. We're not talking significant sums of money here. I don't think there's a big potential for us to abuse the privilege.
Well, I think you might have misunderstood me. I wasn't suggesting that anybody was going to abuse it. It's just a matter of housekeeping on our part, too. So that's the only questions I had, Mr. Chairman.
What is the amount that, if you did lapse it, what is an average?
Currently, all three accounts are projected to go negative by several hundred thousand dollars, and so we don't anticipate lapsing anything this year. In some years, we have had surplus in one area as high as $1 million, but generally it's been offset by an overexpenditure in other areas to a certain degree. So in total, we're talking a couple hundred thousand dollars a year probably.
bring those funds, or are you crediting those accounts?
Mr. Chairman, we have discussed this with the Department of Law, and the way we view this is that we charge the appropriation, an agency appropriation initially, mm-hmm. for the purpose of the expenditure. Once that is charged, that's where the expenditure occurs, mm-hmm. and it's set aside in a liability account mm-hmm. that does not lapse.
Mr. Chairman, so to carry, to go on further here, in other words, mechanically, it isn't going to change the amounts that will be, that would normally lapse or be reappropriated or anything. In other words, you do it presently now. All this does is put it in statute because you're charging those agencies and you're, in essence, crediting it, but you're not doing it under statute.
That is correct, Mr. Chairman. Basically, we're asking the legislature to bless a procedure that we have in place, and in discussions with legislative audit and legislative finance, it was felt that it should be brought to your attention for review. This is the vehicle for doing that.
Further questions, Representative Krieger?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question on line one, or sorry, on page four. Jeez, I'm getting all screwed up. Page one, line four, where it says 1234, it says payment of claims for workers' compensation and general liability.
Yes, Representative.
What is general liability? What does that encompass there?
Mr. Chairman, Don Hitchcock is here from the Division of Risk Management. They could probably better answer that question more specifically. So
Would you come up forward? We can't pick you up on the mic, please.
Don Hitchcock. I'm the director of the Division of Risk Management.
Did you hear the question, Chairman, sir?
The
definition of general liability.
We're talking about third-party liability cases.
Any kind? Car wreck and
yes.
And you got to pay the
damages? Slip and fall, that type thing, on state property.
Okay. Now, on the second page, there is authority to pay those benefits by charging the unencumbered balance of any appropriation enacted to finance the payment of employee salaries. Now, does that mean that, let's say that, the Department of Commerce has an employee that's in a car wreck and you get a $50,000 judgment, they're authorized to go over to the Department of Administration or Public Safety or something if there's some employee salary money there, and pay that money for the claim out of the employee salary in the other division?
Mr. Chairman, in an attempt to answer Representative Rieger's question, I understand your concern. You're trying to match the claim with a specific appropriation.
And also, beyond that, I'm also trying to see if, we're generally talking about employee liabilities for relating to pay, but there's a catch-all at the end that says general liability, which is all the rest of the world.
I think there's some misunderstanding here. Generally speaking, the personal services vehicle has been the most expedient way of collecting money centrally from each operation. The payroll system is set up that we can assess agencies that way, and for years the budget instructions have allowed us to charge agencies' budgets, put monies aside for these liabilities. Okay. And additionally, the liabilities accrue over time, and employees reside, they may transfer between several state agencies and several or many different appropriations over time. And so it is our feeling that the matching principle I think you're trying to address here doesn't really apply. The obligations accrued over time through many different appropriations, so we should be able to assess those appropriations the same way.
One last question, if I can. Does the enactment of this law give you greater flexibility to go from appropriation to appropriation in the budget than you have presently? Now you can only take money within an appropriation to pay for whatever's within that appropriation. This allows you to go farther.
It does not allow us to exceed the appropriation available for personal services.
The aggregate of all
which this is a personal services item as budgeted per the instructions every year.
I guess my question is, if you have an overrun in liabilities for personal services in appropriation A, you can go over to appropriation B to take the overrun.
Yes, we could, but only for these three purposes. We're not putting on more employees. We're only taking care of existing liability claims for the approved PCNs that are out there.
Okay, that's all I have, Mr. Chair.
Other questions? Thank you, gentlemen. Is there anybody else that would like to testify on House Bill number 113, Finance? What's the pleasure of the group?
I'm moving to ask unanimous consent that we pass out CS for HB 113 Finance with the accompanying zero note fiscal note with individual recommendations.
Any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. The last bill we'll take up this afternoon is committee substitute for House Bill number 382. We have before you a committee substitute that came in this afternoon. It makes two major changes in the CS, which is the state employees in the Department of Education under TRS would be included in the program, a new section to clarify the role of OMB. Representative Duncan, this is your bill. I've got a couple of people here to testify also on this.
Okay, I'll try to run through the committee substitute real briefly, the proposed committee substitute for the Finance Committee, and explain as we go through what the bill does. There is one further change in the committee substitute from the original bill that I'll also point out. Perhaps I could start off by taking you through the bill step by step. The purpose statement, I believe, is a very important part of this legislation. It lays out very clearly that because of declining revenues, we are finding it or may find it necessary to reduce personal service costs. This program is intended to do that. And the program only works, the program can only kick in if it results in a net reduction in personal service costs to the state. And that's a very clear statement at the beginning of the bill. The way the program operates is laid out in the following sections, and I'll run through it real quickly. Section 2 provides that the head of a department or agency may designate sections or divisions in which it is necessary to cut back on personal services expenditures, and then based on that designation, may investigate certain divisions, sections, or other classifications of employees to determine whether it is feasible for them to participate in the retirement incentive program. The agency would then prepare a detailed proposal stating the cost of the program, stating the cost of the retirement incentive program, and the offsetting personal service savings for each unit for which they believe participation is possible. And then the agency statement would be reviewed by OMB and by Division of Retirement Benefits to determine that it will meet requirements of the program, the very basic requirements of the program, and that being that it must reduce personal service cost. The subsection B on page 1 of the committee substitute is also a change from what came out of the House State Affairs Committee substitute. We originally had in the bill that came out of the House State Affairs Committee, it said that anyone who participate in this program, you had to have worked for the state 5 years, not just vested in the PERS system, but had 5 years of state employment. It was pointed out to us early this morning that the attorneys in the Attorney General's office felt that there was a constitutional problem with that, so we've had to make some language change. And that appears on the bottom of page 1 that says, a vested member in the public employee retirement system, so that means they have to have 5 years, who's in a designated classification, and who has been continuously employed with the state since January 1st, 1986. And the reason the January 1st, 1986 date has been placed in there is so that after this bill takes effect, individuals who perhaps may be working with the municipality can't all of a sudden decide to transfer to the state to get in on the program. So it's to stop that type of practice and really to benefit those people who are presently in state employment. The other requirement to participate in the system, not only must they have been employed by the state as of 1/1/86, and they must be at a minimum within 3 years of early retirement, and early retirement comes at age 50, so they have to be at a minimum 47 years of age in order to participate in the program. Employees who are eligible to participate are those in the PERS, the state retirement system, which is in AS 39.35, and state employees who are in the teacher's retirement system, and there are a number of those in the Department of Education who are in the teacher's retirement system, and that is the other change in the committee substitute. The subsection C provides that the employee's agency must agree to reimburse the retirement system the actuarially determined difference between what the employee would have received in benefits before the incentive and the amount the employee will receive in benefits after the incentive, including a small allowance for administrative costs. It also provides for the method in which a participant in the retirement incentive program will receive credit. Each participant who retires under the retirement incentive program will receive a credit of 3 years in the following order. One, to reduce the age or years of service required for eligibility for normal retirement. In other words, if you're 47, you become 50. To reduce the actuarial adjustment required for early retirement, which is a little bit more complicated to explain. I think Mr. Humphreys could probably explain that better than I can. And to increase the years of service credit for those already eligible for full retirement. So if someone is 58, they could add 3 years of service credit on to add to their years of service in the state, or a combination of one through three. The bill also provides that if an employee who has retired under this program should return to any employment covered under the public employees or teacher retirement system, then they would have to pay back to the system all additional benefits, including health insurance costs if they received as a result of the program. Specifies very clearly that the only TRS employees that can participate are those in the Department of Education. It does not include municipal or university employees. Section 3 is a new addition to make it a little bit more clear and detailed as to how OMB and the agencies will be involved here. Section 3 provides that when an agency submits its proposal to OMB, it must provide detailed information about the cost and offsetting savings of the agency's participation in the program, and that OMB will then provide a report to the legislature in January of 1987 and 1988 detailing the activity in the program and its effect on personal service costs. Section 4 of the bill provides that an employee must apply for the program prior to July of 1987, but will be eligible to participate if they meet the program requirements prior to October 1st, 1987. We have provided in Section 5 that the program is only available for 1 year, and we've done that just to see how the program works, to see if it is successful, to see if it is reducing personal service costs, to see if there's anyone participating. And if it does look successful, then I would hope the legislature would consider extending it. If it's not successful, if it doesn't work, there's no sense having it on the books, and that's why we've had why we have the one-year requirement. There's several other items in your packet that I wanted to bring to your attention. There's a summary of eligibility for the retirement investment program by department that's been printed out, has broken down into two categories: vested employees at least 47 by October 1st, 87, which is the deadline for participation, and vested employees at least 52 by 10/1/87, broken down by department. The bottom line is there's 2,189, according to this run, 2,189 employees in state government who would be eligible for this program. Now, that's not saying that they'll all participate or that they're all being divisions and departments that would be designated to participate. But it does mean that there are that many eligible who could participate if the agencies, after review, determine that they could be in the program, and then if they volunteer to become involved in the program. There's also an example of a printout that does the example of the savings under the retirement investment program. It lays out some assumptions and gives three different scenarios, and each one of those illustrates that it does result in the savings. That's a real quick run through of what the bill does. I might add that this is, of course, new to the state of Alaska, but it's based on what's been being done in the state of California. And all the information I've been able to see on it has been successful in that state. There has been a reduction in workforce as a result of this type of legislation being enacted. So again, I'd like just to reemphasize the real purpose of introducing this is, I think we all recognize declining revenues and the need to tighten up on government spending. I think this is designed to be somewhat of a rational approach to that. And instead of just laying employees off, it's an attempt to allow government to be reduced in size by offering a retirement incentive program for probably people who've been with state government for a longer period of time and therefore are paid higher would be retired. And then either those positions can be eliminated or they can be filled with lower level people. Mr. Chairman, that's a real quick run through. I think you'll note also there's 2-0 fiscal notes, I believe, one from retirement benefits, and I think one from the division from Office of Management Budget that reflect a 0 fiscal note. They don't reflect savings because it's very difficult to tell what the savings are going to be. But it reflects it's not going to cost anything to put the program in, and then the savings will be generated as we determine how many people will participate in the program.
Questions for the sponsor, Representative Ringstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Now, do I understand this to say this is available for people between now and October of 87? At that point? I mean, some guy in 1989 can't come in and do this?
The way the bill is presently drafted, in fact, I'm glad you brought that up, there was one other change I wanted to propose, and that would be an immediate effective date so that the program could be started right away. But the way the bill is drafted, yes, there is a one-year window that they have to apply before July 1st, 1987, and have to become eligible before October of 87 in order to participate. The reason for that one-year window is to see how the program is working, to see if there needs to be any changes made, to see if it's, you know, if it's not successful, if no agency is designating divisions where people can retire, and if no one is retiring, we're not saving personal service costs, then the program shouldn't continue. It's my hope, as I said, I think it will show a savings. I think we will see a reduction in positions and a reduction in personal service costs. If that happens, then I think we should consider extending it for a longer period of time.
So your intent is to go put it out there as a one-year shot, and if it works, we'll continue. If it doesn't, we won't.
Well, if it works, we have to come back and take action. We have to come back to extend. If we don't extend, then it just dies after that period of time.
One other, just a clarification. You were addressing paragraph B at the bottom of page 1.
Yes.
An agency or an employee who has been continuously employed with the state since January 1, 86. So you're saying somebody has to be employed from January 1, 86 until the time they apply.
That's correct. What we're trying to prohibit is a mass transfer into, if that should happen, from a municipality or perhaps a university into state employment in order to benefit from the program.
What about somebody, I guess, going the other direction, as in opting out or going out of state employment and in the process of leaving wants to get the early retirement?
Under the bill, you actually have to retire, is my understanding. And the minimum requirement is you have to be age 47, because that's early retirement is 50, and the most you can get is 3 years credit, and you'd have to be at least 47. So someone who's just quitting would not.
Getting canned, as the case might be.
Well, I guess. I think that's the correct answer. Perhaps Mr. Humphreys can expand on that.
Representative Larson?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just looking at the eligibility here for the retirement incentive program, let me know if I'm correct or not, please. If you have 17 years of service and you wish to retire under the program, under the retirement system, you would have a multiplier of 17 years toward your retirement benefits. However, if you are presently eligible to retire under the program and you elect to retire under it, you would then be given 3 additional years on your multiplier?
Well, let me answer that if I can, and maybe Mr. Humphreys can add to that. My understanding is if you're presently, let's say, 56 years old, which means you're eligible for full retirement, and you have 17 years of service, then provision in this bill would allow you to retire at that time with 20 years. 20 years would be your multiplier. You would add the 3 years on. That's the only case where you can do that, as I understand. If you're presently 47, for example, and have 17 years, you could retire as if you were 50, take early retirement, but your multiplier would still be 17 years.
Let me go, I guess, directly to the question, if I may. It says, a 55-year-old with 22 years of service, at the present time, a 55-year-old with 22 years of service would get 44% of their top 3 years average. But under this program, a 55-year-old with 22 years of service would not get 44%, but they would actually get 50% of their best 3 years.
That's correct. That's correct. And the reason that is the third option, in order, I think, as you go through here. And that's, again, to encourage
someone who's eligible to
encourage someone who's eligible to get off the rolls and reduce state personnel costs.
Yeah. But that multiplier there would have some fiscal, but yet there would be savings because you'd be hiring back.
That has been taken into consideration. Probably Mr. Humphreys can explain that better. Yes, I mean, you're going to have, there's going to be a retirement. In fact, if you look at the handout, examples of savings under RIP, it's a bad RIP, retirement incentive program.
Not a reflection on the people who are in it.
Not a reflection. If you look at the first example where it says eligible, there's three eligibles and their salaries and benefits are $200,000. The total retirement incentive program costs $111,000. That's the actuarial cost of funding those 3 years of service. But in the long term, and even that's a savings, $90,000 almost, but over the long term, it's a much greater savings than that. Of course, the bottom line is none of this can work. No one can retire under this unless it's been verified by OMB and the department that it will reduce the cost of personal services to the state. There will be a reduction. And that reduction can come about by holding positions vacant or by filling at a lower level. Hope I kind of answered your question.
Mm-hmm. It's time the chair calls up Mr. Humphrey. Do you have anything to add before we have people ask us some questions?
No, Mr. Chairman, thank you. I think that was a good description of what the bill does. I'd be happy to respond to questions.
Representative Rieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just walking through the bill, I just have questions on some of the terms. On the finance CS, page 2, line 11, the member's agency signs a reimbursement agreement. How enforceable is it? First of all, who is the other side signing the agreement, and how enforceable is that?
Okay, the way I picture that, the member's agency is the department, picturing an agreement signed by the department head, not a director, and the other agency is the retirement system, for which I would presumably sign as the administrator. I would like to suggest, as a matter of fact, that gets to a slight technical change in that particular section since we've come right to it. It currently reads, the member's agency signs a reimbursement agreement that requires the agency to reimburse the system within 3 years after the date. The member is appointed to retirement in an amount equal to and so forth. It describes it. What I would like to suggest that it should be changed to read is that the member's agency has signed a reimbursement agreement that requires the agency to reimburse the system within 3 years after the date for each member who is appointed to retirement during the agency's period of participation in an amount equal to, and then the rest of it, being that I picture that the head of the agency would come in and sign one agreement agreeing that they would pay the costs for whoever might retire, not that they would come in and sign a separate agreement after each member elected to retire, with the possibility that there might be some balking after a couple of members had elected to, the thought being that this window, once opened, needs to be fairly open to that whole class of people that had been designated for the whole window period, that the agency couldn't try to manipulate it and maybe have a couple of people set up to retire so they could squeeze them out and then not have it fairly offered to all people in whatever classification it was that had been approved. That's one reason, and the other is just from an administrative point of view, I'm looking at one agreement, not coming in and doing a separate deal with the agency every time somebody elected to take advantage of it and retire. But yes, I think it would be, well, I mean, I think it's as enforceable as any other part in the law, I mean, any other contract. There is a further part down here that says that contributions from the agency to the system under this section, that is to say what they owe under this agreement, would take precedence over other obligations of the agency. And what I would picture doing is at the first of each fiscal year, dunning that agency for their costs. And that those, what I'm interpreting this to mean is that the legislature is giving me carte blanche to take this off the top of their personal services. And if they are short, then it would have to result in layoffs later in the year, not a reneging on an agreement to pay this part of the cost to the system.
Well, I guess, you know, you touched on another question I had, because I read that, what you just read, but then it goes on to say, to the maximum extent permitted by law. And I'm no lawyer, but it sounds like it might be a loophole that says, well, everything else comes first, contracts, personal services, whatever. So if what you're testifying is correct, that you have a carte blanche to take off the top, that's one thing. But if this is a way that you just take if they're, you know, lapsed money at the end of the fiscal year, it's quite another.
We might get some, legal comment on that. It's my understanding, though, that there aren't very many things that would come ahead of it.
I would like to know that. And then that would also, when that comes, could answer the question that says, requires the agency to reimburse the system within 3 years. And what if 3 years go by and it's not reimbursed? Then what? Maybe that those all go together. Maybe we can get a legal comment and answer. But if I can go on, could you explain to me what page 3, the first line, means to reduce the actuarial adjustment required for early retirement?
Yes. A good example of that might be a person who is 51 years old, let us say, and is in one of these designated classifications. They are already eligible for early retirement, and that is the first category. That is the first thing that the 3 years of credit have to be used for. Well, they don't need to be used for that because a 51-year-old person is already eligible. Okay. However, a person who retires at age 51 has a reduction in their retirement benefit, an actuarial reduction for early retirement that amounts to, say, somewhere 6 to 7% per year. 6 to 7%. What we would do is treat that 51-year-old person as though he or she were 54 years old. In other words, add the 3 years to his or her age so that they would have only a 1 year's early retirement reduction instead of a 4 year's reduction.
Okay, that's, thank you. One last question, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I'm thinking back to the parental leave bill that we had a while ago. And there was a fiscal note on that, and you know, an employee could leave, take early retirement under this system, and then come back. And that's what the last sections of this bill provide for. And that employee incurs an indebtedness, and then at the time of retirement has, as you explained it to me, an option of whether to take the retirement or not. And there was an adverse selection that went on, and there was a fiscal note because of that. Here's my question: is there the same kind of exposure to adverse selection here with this provision that you can leave and then come back?
No, this would not be an indebtedness for service credit, is one thing. That would not apply. Also, here we're talking about basically an amount that is exactly determined. We're talking about the amount of the benefit they actually did receive. So we're not talking about a prospective determination where the actuary is asked to look into the future. We're talking about an actual determination of the amount of benefits that person actually did receive, including the health insurance benefits. So it is quite simply a matter of adding it up, and we know that we will have 100% of it. Yeah, so there, in this instance, there is no possibility for adverse selection in the sense of someone returning.
That's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Frank.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Humphreys, what did you, or maybe Representative Duncan can answer, did you arrive at a three-year period of time, one at five or two?
I guess the answer is that it was somewhat arbitrary. The state of California had a two-year incentive, 2 years' worth of service credit. House Bill 382, as it was originally drafted, provided 5 years of service credit. California, the California program seemed to be working with only two. However, we had contemplated, or House Bill 382 had contemplated five. So, to some extent, that was part of the way between two and five. I think that's one of the reasons, and Representative Duncan pointed it out, one of the reasons for having a sunset on the window period, aside from the fact of helping agencies cut it out. That wasn't mentioned, but if you have an agency that applies, they're presumably applying for a point in time. They have a group of employees that they're looking at that they want to target it for. And this agency would not presumably want this opportunity to continue ad infinitum. They want to try to get rid of perhaps a few range 20 step Zs, and then once that is done, they would like to, get back and no longer participate. So this gives them a way out. But also that window gives the legislature an opportunity to come back and examine the 3 years with a little bit of experience under our belt here, particularly in this state, to see if 3 years is the right amount. Was that sufficiently attractive? Did agencies that were participating find that they were able to attract a significant number of the people they would like to see retire into retirement with that, or was it not enough? So it was a middle-of-the-road estimate of what we thought was reasonable without really having any way to prove it. One year's of, worth of experience should hopefully shed a lot of light on that, and is one good reason for looking at it.
If I could follow that up, Mr. Chairman. From the California experience, were we not able to make any kind of estimate based on their experience about what our experience might be, and also did theirs contain a one-year sunset too?
I don't believe that it was 1 year. I think, as best I recall, they did for three different periods, and I'm not sure if they were for 1 year each. Each of them was a separate window, though, and there they did it by executive order. I haven't spent a lot of time doing that. I do not think that the California experience would shed a lot of light on it without knowing which agency we're talking about. We have so much variability, difference in the pay structure, and really a lot of difference from one agency to another here in what we're talking about. I think what we really have to do is to get some idea of how it works here. The part that I liked about the legislation was that it will require whatever agency is applying to look at the particular employees that they have in their agency, and their submission that they might make to try to indicate that they're going to save money with this might include, and I think it would be a fair idea for it to include, some sort of a survey of the employees to indicate how many of them feel that they might take advantage of it, that they could do this, and that way you could at least target it and offer it to the employees where you want it without, like some retirement incentive programs that have worked out badly in some areas where the employees that ended up taking advantage of it were in the areas maybe where they were having difficulty recruiting anyway, and you ended up with a real fiasco, which I do not think certainly this would result in.
You cannot answer Representative Frank's question regarding the 3 years that California had early retirements by executive order, how much personal savings in any one of those 3 years?
No, Mr. Chairman, I can't.
Sure.
Representative Duncan.
Yeah. I don't have the dollar figure, but let me just kind of run through it. It was in four phases. Phase one was in 1983. Nine departments participated. 1,310 people retired. Phase two, also in 1983, 16 departments participated with 304 retirees. Phase three in 1984, three departments with 110 retirees. Then phase four in 1985, phase four was ongoing when this was written, but as of June 10th of 1985, 1,300 employees had retired. So in that less than 2 year period of time, 3,000 employees had participated in the program and retired. I don't have in this information dollar figure attached to it, but it appears that as a substantial number of employees. And as I read off, we have what the figure was, 2,800 employees who 2189, what the figure, whatever it was, who meet the age requirements right now and who could participate 2189 total, who could participate in the program. So I think it's difficult to project how many of those will, but there's that many eligible, and the California experience shows that a large number did participate.
Is there further questions? Representative Szymanski.
I've had an opportunity. I'm glad the sponsor did the run out here because I'd asked DOT to do it earlier. I guess when I'm thinking about implementation of it, part of it gets into when we get into, assuming we get into budget reductions and so forth this next year. I like the idea. I mean, to me, it looks good to try to deal with it in this way. And particularly when I look at DOT, I know where most of these 630 are that are here, and they're way up on the upper end of it. And it's almost impossible to deal with that top-heavy structure. even through reorganization, through anything, because of the bumping process and everything else, I just see no drawbacks to it. I see nothing but pluses and positive, being a good positive move. And I can see where it's going to benefit, or potentially will benefit, the budget area I work in that DOT. I mean, I look at 630 of that, and that's a significant number, that 2,100, and I don't know how many take it, but if a third of that end up being impacted, that's a substantial number on the top end. But do you see any problem with regard to working out the mechanics and do we need any more definition in the bill than is existing there with regard to precluding any abuse by departments in any way, shape, or form the way it currently is? I mean, I'm looking for any loopholes that may exist.
Well, I think it's a good idea to look for them. I don't see them right now, or I would have made a further suggestion, but I think it's not a bad idea to look for them. I like
your idea already. I mean, the one where you came up and said, let's just go with them.
I like what has been put into this last draft, which does require I was talking with staff here in your committee, and we tried to improve it a little bit in that respect, and it does require a report to the legislature, which I assume would mean essentially to the finance committees, on these settings, so that the agencies that are presumably going to save money and have come forward with a plan indicating that they're going to leave X positions vacant and that they can fill so many positions at a lower grade, that this would accompany their budget submission. And so to a very real extent, this committee, as well as the Senate side, would have a sort of an oversight on what had happened. And so I think there's some real reason to believe that savings can result. I don't know how appropriate it is to try to in essence, prescribe a form that would be used to apply to OMB. I would think that would be something for OMB itself to set down a few rules about how they wanted agencies to apply. For our own part, we'll be in the position to supply cost information by individual that's very accurate, because we're looking at just 3 years. You know, so we're not projecting lifetimes, really. We know exactly what it is. We know the individual's amount of service. We know the salary. And we can, when the agencies come to us, what I picture happening is they'll be coming and saying, well, we have 8 employees eligible, or maybe saying, how many employees do we have eligible? And we'd say, well, it's the following 8 employees, and give them the cost by individual for retiring that particular individual. In other words, what we've been calling the cost of the window. And we can respond with that.
Okay, now have you priced that window, say, 5 years versus 3 years?
No. In a word, it would be approximately 66% more. Yeah, I mean, you know, just as 5 years to 3.
But as far as numbers go, affected groups, would it shift drastically or be proportionately about the same between departments?
Well, the number of individuals would also be quite a lot greater. If not,
I mean, numbers be greater, but proportionately, you're going to find much difference, you think, between departments?
I do not think so. I think you would find about the same distribution. I can't guarantee that because I haven't looked at it, but I feel reasonably comfortable that that's what you would see.
I'd like to see 5 years myself. I mean, because I've seen where they did it, like Arkowitz, Ohio, did it recently. It was 5 years that they used it, and I think they did a good job on it. 5 years would be...
I don't know. My only thought on that is when we looked at some of these projections, like the sheet that Representative Duncan showed you here, is that what we find with the 3 years is that in a lot of standard cases, you're talking about an incentive cost that is less than the cost of 1 year of payroll. You know, in the 60, 70, 80% range of 1 year's salary. And it makes it possible to afford this if you're the department by maybe coming in and filling a super great employee, maybe out here at M-Step, and by just simply at the A range. You can actually show savings that way. If you go all the way to the 5 years, it gets a little bit harder, and more it gets to be the case that the only way that you're going to be able to show savings is by filling it, leaving some of them vacant, in essence. And my only thought was, gosh, it's easy to come back and offer more the next time. If we find that you know, not enough people responded to this, it would be real easy for the legislature to come back this time next year and say, gosh, you know, we're just not getting enough people to reply to retire. Let's jack it up a notch and get some of the holdouts.
Is there any way you can come up with a chart of cost comparison with this bill versus straight layoffs?
I don't know how to offhand, Mr. Chairman. We've been sort of at a loss of how to compare what the savings would be here. The face of the bill pretty much guarantees that there will be some, but I've been at a loss to give you a good indication of how much it would be.
I'm trying to share that. And if I could respond, I don't think that's a hard question to answer just in general terms. I think dollar terms it is, but it's quite obvious that if you just lay off 50 employees, instead of letting the 50 employees take a retirement incentive program, you're going to save more money by laying them off. They're going to be out of work, and they're not going to be able to retire because they didn't meet, in many cases, the retirement criteria, the eligibility. So